Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Cliff. If you are a regular listener to Earth Ancients, you've enjoyed the program, you thought the guests were great, you know, let me know. Go to iTunes and write a review. Real quick, you can just put in 4 stars, 3 stars, you know, whatever you feel is important. But when you review the show, it helps grow the program and gets the word out. More people will learn about it. So do me a favor, would you? Go to the iTunes website and just click in Earth Ancients and give us a quick review. And I'd really appreciate it. Hey, by the way, we have best-selling author Doug Preston today, and he's written a cool book called The Lost City of the Monkey God. And boy, I'm looking forward to interviewing him today. So here's the program for this week. For Saturday, March 25th, 2017, this is Cliff Dunn, your host. Welcome to Earth Ancients. You know, I've had a lot of people ask me why I don't write more, you know, books, articles, and blogs. Boy, I'll tell you, it's tough. It's tough to get the time into to write. And I am, you know, like everybody else, trying to make a living, you know, doing my thing. But I decided that I'm going to start writing columns, and Ancient Origins magazine, which is out of the UK, has offered me a chance to write a monthly article. And I wasn't really sure about doing that for a while, because I just didn't want to have it posted in other areas. I wanted to just keep it on my website. But after looking at Ancient Origins, it's an online magazine. I checked out their history, what they cover, and it's very closely aligned to Earth Ancients. And so I've agreed to write a regular article. My first article is going to come out probably in early April. And I'm not going to tell you what it's about, but no, it just gives me a chance to write a little bit about some of the content that's on this show, some of my ideas. I run into a lot of different authors. I'm still a conference program director of content for various shows here in the Bay Area. And I have an opportunity to speak with the who's who of ancient past, present-day thinking, mindfulness, a whole variety of topics that I don't get a chance to talk about here on the show. So I think it's a good opportunity. And so I'll start announcing when these articles come out. They'll also appear on Earth Ancients website. And if you haven't signed up for Earth Ancients website yet, do so. Go to earthancients.com. That's ancients with an S. Sign up, register, and that way you're going to get the newsletter that comes out every couple of months. And I'm trying to stick a free ebook in each of those newsletters. I get a bunch of ebooks sent to me by authors, and they say, yeah, sure. Happy to have you post information about the book or the actual book on the, on your website. So again, go to earthancients.com, register. And I have a lot of information on there. The blog's going to be there, and I'm going to start building up the site. But most importantly, you want to get that newsletter. There's just a lot to cover every month, and I can't get it all on the show, so the newsletter kind of helps. So check it out, earthancients.com. Hey, Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia, and Gaia is promoting a series of programs that you should check out. Here's a list, a quick list. He's got Gaia's got Cosmic Disclosure, which is tracing the roots of the secret space program. That's hosted by Dave Wilcock and Corey Good. And you can see this and about 7,000 other titles, which is kind of amazing. They grow at each week with new programs. And to get this program and many, many others, go to Gaia.com, that's G-A-I-A.com, /Earth Ancients. And when you go to that page, you're going to see some topics that have been selected for Earth Ancients, but you're also going to get the list of thousands of titles on a wide variety of subjects: mindfulness, meditation, ancient history, UFOs, ancient aliens. And here's a few other topics that are coming up. Beyond Belief, which is hosted by George Norrie. This week he's talking about Atlantis with Carmen Bolter. Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe. Now, Linda Moulton Howe is one of the foremost authorities on alien animal mutilation. Doesn't sound very interesting, but it's quite an interesting topic. And then Greg Braden, we've had Greg on the show. His Missing Links program is featuring a special episode on self-healing. And then Open Minds, Regina Meredith is talking about George Adamski. George Adamski is one of the first UFO contactees. So anyhow, Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And you think that would cost a ton of money, but actually all they're charging for the first month is 99 cents. 99 cents for your first month, and then it's about $9 after that. So check it out. I think you're going to like it. It's a fantastic deal and good programming across the board, high production values.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And each week we feature a lot of material, and I'm just going to highlight a few items, but I always advise you to, if you're listening to the show, we have galleries, we have excellent articles, and a lot of content on Earth Ancients topics. So it's go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients with an S, and then go to the group page, and you'll see just a ton of material. So this week, a couple of the items that I wanted to feature is that we have a rock face gallery. So what is that? Rock faces are faces that have been cut into rock. Some of these things are colossus. They're huge. They're one of these huge faces in Italy, I think is about, it's 80 by 80 feet. Some smaller ones that are closer to the ground. And this is a collection, the Rock Face Gallery. You can see it on Facebook. It's a collection of humongous, colossal faces, heads, cut into rock. Some are deeply eroded. Others are what people consider giant faces, but they may not be faces. They might be heads. They may not be anything. They might be a natural formation. But anyhow, I'll leave it to your discretion to figure out which one of these are true rock faces carved in from the antiquities, or if they are natural formations. There's about 30 different images in this gallery, so check that out. It's kind of interesting. Hey, last week I reported about this colossus, this 26-foot tall sculpture in Egypt that was found in a Cairo slum. It was thought to be a Ramsey II, Ramsey II carving. As it turns out, it's a lesser-known pharaoh, Psamtek I, who lived between 664 and 610 BC, almost 3,000 years ago. But I've posted a complete gallery. They've excavated the entire piece. And they had like a part of a head that was sticking out of the ground, and some kid uncovered it. And all of a sudden they got in there and bulldozed it up and picked it up. And you can see the entire colossus. It's huge, and not Ramsey the Second at all. It's actually somebody else. So those are kind of cool. That kind of information is great. 3,000, almost 3,000 year old colossus, beautifully carved granite sculpture, 26 feet tall. You can see the entire thing on the Facebook page. Finally, retired professor Mike Ruggieri, who's a regular contributor, he's been actually collecting quite a bit of imagery and content on Mesoamerica, Central America, and parts of South America. And his galleries are fascinating. I've studied his galleries for probably, I want to say, 5 to 7 years. Could be longer. In fact, actually, Professor Ruggieri is going to be my guest next week to talk a little bit about his collection, what he's been doing, his great interest on Mesoamerica. But anyhow, this gallery that he's posted this week is an Olmec sculpture gallery, beautiful artifacts that are found from the Olmec civilization. And he doesn't just collect one or two. Professor Ruggieri collects thousands and thousands of images. And so this is quite a sophisticated gallery, and you can get a link to his other galleries. He is a prolific researcher and collector of imagery. So Earth Ancients on the Facebook page. Remember, go to the group page rather than the international page, because that is where you're going to find all this information. Each week, tons of material. So each week we have regular contributors, authors, research investigators who post their articles on the Facebook page. This week we have Ashley Cowie, who is a TV host in Scotland, well known in the UK, and we've had Ashley on the show before. And this week, he has a fascinating article on his homeland, which is in Scotland. And he has discovered some megaliths there that have led him to some interesting conclusions. Earth Ancients has a number of contributors to its Facebook page. Each week, we have noted authors, a number of independent research investigators who are posting articles or galleries of their material. And recently we had the return of Ashley Cowie, who we've had on the show. Ashley is a TV host, author, and he's an explorer. And he wrote an article called Odin's Valkyries and Scotland's Viking Moon Map, which is a very, very interesting article. It's a follow-up to an early article about a discovery he made in Scotland. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this article. So we have Ashley on the program. Ashley, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me back.
Cool. Hey, tell me a little bit about this Sisa area that you've actually traced to fairly old period, 4,000 years, I believe, and what the significance of this discovery is.
Okay, so Sisa is a hillock located at the northeast coast of Scotland. It's one of the remotest landscapes in Europe. I mean, it's the northwesternmost point of land. It is the heart of agricultural Neolithic lifestyles. There's more burial cairns and structures from the Neolithic period, which is between 4,000 and 2,500 BC than anywhere else in Europe. Sisa Mound is a hillock located right at the heart of Neolithic Scotland. What I discovered there were two myths associated to the mound, and the myths are both constructed with number systems and indications towards directions. So what I've managed to do is unfold both of these myths and relate them to the greater landscape and interpret them.
Okay. So in a nutshell, tell us about this this mapping system. I guess it tracks the summer solstice. Is that correct?
Yeah, what we've got is a Viking myth. We have a Viking myth, which is central to Scandinavian Norse mythology. It's about, so what happens is at Sysa, the myth goes that on the day of the Battle of Clontarf in 1014, the Irish and the Norse did their last battle in Ireland. On that day, 12 riders were seen riding into the Sysa hillock. And a local man looked in and watched these 12 Valkyrs weaving a web of fate in 12 individual pieces. Well, I took all the elements of that myth, and I assumed for a moment, what if there's a deeper meaning here? Why 12 women? So I relate that back to the Norse myth of the 12 Valkyrs of Odin, the choosers of the slain. But they were also the keepers of the moon calendar. So I took the 12 sections of the fatal web of the Valkyrs and overlaid it on the landscape and related it to the 12 lunar months of the year, the 6 dark months, the 6 light months. And what I've done is found that the parts of the myth describe elements of Viking astronomy. That's essentially what I've found, Cliff.
Wow. I didn't know the Vikings had an astronomy. It's almost like they had their own cosmology, like the Maya or somebody. So they actually track the seasons through the heavens, would you say?
Let's come back from 12th and 10th and 11th century myths about the Vikings. Since the 4th, 5th, and 6th century, these Viking navigators were exploring distant lands. They were launching war campaigns. They were super agriculturalists. They knew the cycles of the sun and the moon and Venus like the back of their hands. About the 11th century, that was transferred into tablets of texts of astronomy, whereby they had actually drawn up lunar charts and solar charts. So predictions about what the sun and the moon and the tides and the weather was going to do became a real science to the Vikings, albeit not in written form that we have it today. This was a symbolic language of runic symbols and of verbal and orally passed on information. And as you say, the Vikings were no different from the Polynesians or from the Incas. They had vast volumes of astronomical information that were passed down orally, and they retained them. One thing those guys had better than us was memory. Memory in history is something that's often overlooked. But, I don't know about you, but I think I could remember 3 mobile telephone numbers today. I remember 20 years ago, I could remember 30 landline numbers, because the only way of getting in touch with a friend was to remember the numbers. We're losing the skills of memory. It's all they had in ancient days.
That's fascinating. What are the Valkyries? Are they myths or are they actual women? Tell me about them.
Yeah, so the Valkyries, the 12 Valkyrs of Odin, they're depicted in modern Christianized times as elegant, virginal, white-robed maidens. But in the old ancient Norse religion, the Valkyrs were hags, sinister beasts, sinister old hags that rode about on black horses. Now, they were attributed, their sort of social function were the choosers of the slain. Now, these entities, if you like, the 12 Valkyrs used to ride it and touch the soldiers who were to fall and go to Valkyrs' halls, go to Odin's halls of Valhalla. So they were associated with the chosen. They were the choosers of the slain. They were associated with foresight and predictions, being able to predict the outcomes and the fallings of kings in battles, just as we see with the Sysa legend, where the 12 Valkyrs predicted the death of both Sigurd, the Viking Jarl of Orkney and Caithness, and King Brian of Ireland. They predicted that both those kings were going to fall, and they fell. That prediction was made from the Sysa Mound, and the fall of Jarl Sigurd was one of the seminal turning points in European history. It was basically when the Norse were kicked out of Ireland. It was when Christianity really won the battle for Ireland. All predicted from a hillock in Caithness and hidden with the myth of 12 Valkyrs sewing a web of fate. It's quite marvelous stuff, to be honest.
It's pretty cool, actually, yeah.
I should really tell you what I actually study, what's in one of my arts. So it's a section of study called sacred geography. So what it is it's interpreting myths and relating them to astronomical alignments on the landscape. It's as simple as that, and it appears in every ancient culture. I've spent 4 months doing it in South America. I'm in Scotland now, and next week I'm about to release a section of articles about Cambodia, the ancient Khmer astronomy, and the alignment of the temples there. It's very, very similar to Celtic and very, very similar to South American animistic views of the world. So I'm going to be taking us to Cambodia next week.
Perfect. All right. Hey, Ashley, thank you, and we look forward to future articles.
Great stuff. Thanks for having me on again.
Okay. So Ashley was coming to us from Colombia, South America, and hey, you know, I try to reach out to people around the world. A lot of the people we have are in Europe. We've had people in Russia. Ashley's in South America. Sometimes Skype tweaks things a little bit, so excuse those issues. We do what we can. Thank God for Skype, though. Boy, it's really a lifesaver. So, yeah, that was fun. Ashley's a regular contributor to the program, so I hope you enjoyed that. We have a great deal of people on the program. We have a number of authors. We have a number of research investigators that talk about their work, talk about the ancient past. But this week, I decided to go after somebody who had actually trekked through an ancient area. And this is our guest this week. It's Doug Preston. Doug's a prolific author, and he's written a number of best-selling books. But he's written a new book that's quite startling. I just finished reading it, called The Lost City of the Monkey God. And this new book's getting a tremendous amount of interest, a lot of play, because it was a harrowing experience, not only for him, but for the team that was assembled to go out and find this lost city in the Honduran jungles. And this was a place that had been noted about in myths, but I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. So here it is. Douglas Preston, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, it's good to be here.
Your new book, The Lost City of the Monkey God, is a fascinating look into really a scientific expedition into a lost city, which until recently was really a myth. You wrote, you know, basically that Coronado, one of the Spanish explorers, was aware of the White City, and they actually chronicle it. But were there other stories of the natives that you were able to discover on this lost city?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there are quite a number of legends that are both from the indigenous people and from Europeans who searched for the lost city, and others.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stories are kind of similar. They talk about a great city that was deep in these mountains, that was swept by a series of catastrophes. The people decided the gods were angry at them and left, leaving all their possessions behind, and that mm-hmm. anyone who returns to the lost city will be struck down and die of disease. So that's the legend,
that's
and it
bad.
Seems to be consistent
yeah.
over the centuries.
It's interesting. To your knowledge, did any of the conquistadors reach the city or have connections with the natives who may have talked about the city?
Well, Cortez didn't, but there was a friar, a missionary, back in 1540 who was traveling through these mountains and with some native guides, and he came to a hill or a bluff, and he found himself looking down on a huge city, which his guide said was a very wealthy city where the people ate off plates of gold and silver mm-hmm. and so on. But it was too hard to get down into that valley, so they just continued on. But he did write a letter to the Emperor Charles V in which he reported this observation, and that may be another source for the legend of the lost city of the monkey god or the white city.
Interesting.
Other than the LIDAR survey equipment that you guys used, what other equipment was in play? I know, I think, I'm trying to remember, did you use satellite imagery or anything else before the LIDAR came about?
Yes. Back in the 90s, the people who were searching for this lost city, and I was part of that group, went to NASA, to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they worked with a guy named Ron Blum, who was the world's expert on remote sensing of the Earth from space. And so Blum and his team looked at satellite imagery from Landsat. They looked at radar imagery taken from the space shuttle of this very remote area of Honduran rainforest to see if they might be able to perceive something beneath the jungle canopy. And in fact, in this one valley that that they only called Target One, they thought that they could see unnatural rectilinear and curvilinear structures. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of difficult to go farther than that with this 150-foot jungle canopy.
Interesting. How important was the use of the LIDAR survey equipment in your expedition?
Well, the LIDAR was absolutely crucial, because LIDAR is thousands of times more powerful than the technology that they're using at NASA, because, of course, it was 20 years later. This was in 2012, and the expedition brought down a plane from the University of Houston, which the guts had been ripped out and this LIDAR machine had been put inside. And this machine fires 125,000 laser pulses a second down into the jungle canopy and then measures the reflections. And even in the thickest jungle in the world, there's some gaps in the leaves. I mean, if you lie down on the ground and look up, you're still going to see little bits of blue sky. And so these billions and billions of laser pulses find those holes in the canopy, and a few of them reflect off the ground. And so they can, using software, they can remove all the trees and actually map what's on the ground in amazing detail.
Yeah, it's a fascinating technology. We had Dr. Richard Hansen on with us a couple of weeks ago, and he's working at the Mirador ruin, the Mayan ruin in Guatemala, and it's been, the LIDAR has been amazing. I have to ask you, though, it seems like there's a number of scientists in the academic world who are very unhappy with LIDAR, and they feel it very, it devalues the discoveries. What do you say about that kind of impression? It seems to me that that's a little harsh.
Well, anytime a new and revolutionary technology is introduced, I mean, it's a human nature. There are always going to be members of the old guard who are unhappy. And so when we discovered this city using LIDAR, there were some archaeologists who said, well, you know, this is this city was not discovered by archaeologists. It was discovered by engineers, and they didn't like that. And they also didn't like the fact that LIDAR is very expensive and hard to afford. I mean, it cost our team almost $1 million to LIDAR this valley. Now, we did find an incredible lost city, so I'd say the investment paid off, but most archaeologists look at that and say, well, where the heck am I going to get $1 million? So there was some carping about that, but young archaeologists are really thrilled with the technology. Some of them say it's the greatest advance in archaeology since carbon-14 dating.
Yeah, I would think it would be a big positive, because it would save man hours getting into a location, frugally looking for something that you're not sure about. I mean, this technology, it's so accurate. I mean, it actually reveals, you know, structures. So I'm just curious as to why they would be unhappy about it. But I guess they maybe consider you kind of an Indiana Jones approach to archaeology. Strange.
Well, they do. They also didn't like the fact that the team had filmmakers as part of the team. I mean, there's a group of filmmakers who are making the most amazing documentary about this discovery, and I mean, I personally think it's a great thing. It teaches people about archaeology, about how discoveries are made, and they actually, you know, had filmmakers there filming the actual discovery of the city, the first entry of human beings into the city since it had been abandoned. I mean, these are it's amazing footage. And and I think that's all a good thing because, you know, it teaches people about archaeology.
Well, this is another question. I'm glad you mentioned that. This is a very remote part of Honduras. And do you think that they're one day going to be able to fly people in there? Or is it more likely to be an observational presentation where they take 3D scans and people look at it through the comfort of their home, or it's a series of film presentations that are shown on National Geographic?
Well, the Honduran government has been interested in developing this site as a high-end ecotourist destination. So, you know, somebody pays $10,000, they can go in by helicopter, and that way the jungle is preserved because they don't have any plans to clear this ruin. They don't want to touch it too much. They have done some excavations, but very, very little. They want to keep it as it is. But there's a problem with that idea, a very severe problem, and that is that the valley, it turns out, is a hot zone of disease. And it appears that this really is the basis for that legend about anyone who enters the lost city will become ill and die. I mean, it really is true. There's a deadly disease in the valley. There's no way to prevent it. You know, it's not like malaria that you can take pills. Mm-hmm. And once you get it, it's incurable. So, and it's a really awful flesh-eating parasite. So,
yeah, I want to talk about that in a minute. But go ahead.
I think that's going to be a deterrent to tourism for a long time to come.
Okay. Have scientists determined the type of civilization it was? We know it's not Mayan, but do they believe it might have been a Mayan offshoot of some kind?
They do believe that. They think, you know, it's remarkable the civilization grew up along the Maya frontier, and it's, you know, they occupied at their height some 10,000 square miles. I mean, this was a huge and important civilization. And what their connection to the Maya is still very mysterious. They were about 200 miles west, east of Copan. So they definitely traded with the Maya. They probably fought battles with the Maya. And after Copan collapsed in 900 AD, this civilization had a flowering and began to take on many aspects of Maya culture, like they started to build pyramids. They started to play the famous Mesoamerican ball game, which, you know, where the losers sometimes lost their heads. So they took on a lot of aspects of Maya culture. But the question is, how did that come to them? Were refugees from Copan, did they go eastward and settle there and bring with them Mayan ideas, or did a group of warriors come and conquer them from Copan? I mean, all these are possibilities, but nobody really knows the answers yet.
That's interesting. You brought up something just now that I was curious about. You wrote about in your book a pyramid, and is it a typical Mesoamerican pyramid where it's stone stacked upon stone, or was it mud? I wanted to get some clarification from you because I was very curious about that.
It was not a typical Mesoamerican pyramid built out of cut stone. It was built out of earth, and it was probably a natural hill that had been modified into a pyramid shape. But in addition to that, the builders would have used adobe to build it up, and that adobe would have been beautifully plastered and carved. And then the superstructure on the pyramid probably was built with gorgeous hardwoods, beautifully polished, you know, rosewood and mahogany, and draped with remarkable textiles, because they believed this civilization had a very advanced weaving technology. So the pyramid would have looked just as spectacular as a Maya pyramid, but after 500 years of rot and rain and decay, all that's left is that earthen core. So all the beautiful, you know, superstructure is gone now, which is unfortunate. So it's so this city didn't look nearly as spectacular as the Maya city of Copan did when it was discovered or found by John Lloyd Stevens, because a lot of it was gone. And it also, the jungle is so thick. It's some of the thickest jungle in the world. You really can't see anything at all when you're standing there. Honestly, if you put that jungle down in Times Square and stood in the middle of it, you wouldn't even be able to see that you were in the middle of a city of tall buildings.
Interesting. Hey, do you kind of feel that you're like a Stevens in a way, reporting for the National Geographic, that you're given the privilege of going along with these scientists to go to the remote places? Is that kind of how you feel in a way?
I do. I feel very fortunate, you know, that I can, you know, take part in some of these great expeditions. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to read, you know, H. Rider Haggard, King Solomon's Mines, you know, all these books about adventure and discovery. And then as I got older, I realized, well, all these lost cities have been found. Everything's been found. It's too bad. I was born too late. But it turns out I wasn't born too late. There still are lost cities to be found. And I feel incredibly fortunate to have been on this expedition into this city, and that I could write a book about it and share it with everyone, The Lost City of the Monkey God. I mean, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life.
Yeah, it was fascinating. It's a fascinating book. I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but archaeologists have noticed that a lot of Mayan cities are aligned to the rising sun. In some cases, there's star cosmology alignments that are very distinct. Do you, has there any determination been made to know if this city is aligned with any cosmology at all?
The city does appear to have alignments in it. It's you know, again, we haven't mapped a lot of the city, but the very first thing we found when we entered the city was this really beautiful and interesting row of giant altar stones that had been placed on quartz boulders. And one of these stones had a remarkable line of quartz in it that had been chiseled out, and it looked all very deliberately aligned, and when you look at that line of quartz, you see that it's pointing due north. So there's at least one significant alignment. There are probably others. That kind of analysis is still being done by the archaeologists who are studying the site, but it probably is going to show that there were similar alignments here as with the Maya cities, like Copan and the other ones. So, yes, I think that is definitely going to be part of the new discoveries that are made as the city is explored further.
Do you know if the LIDAR scans are accurate enough to provide that kind of information? I'm not really familiar with them, but if they are as accurate as you describe them, as I've seen, possibly they could lend themselves to be a very accurate determinations for, you know, building alignments.
Well, the LIDAR is absolutely accurate in that regard and could show. And in fact, I'm just looking up some of the LIDAR images here as we talk on my computer, and there's a definitely a north-south, east-west alignment of the city to the cardinal directions, even though the valley kind of is a northwest, southeast trending valley. The alignments of the city are much more on the cardinal directions. Okay. So, yes, I mean, I'm looking at them right now, and I'd say you're absolutely right.
Fantastic. Well, that's very, very interesting. A big question a lot of people have, and I do have, is will we ever see these artifacts, or is it relegated to the Honduras government to keep for their own museums and public displays?
The Honduran government is very interested in sharing this discovery with the rest of the world. Now, the artifacts are still being excavated. I'll just give your listeners a bit of a background here. At the base of the pyramid, we made the most important discovery of the expedition, which was a cache of sacred objects. They were sculptures that had been placed there, hundreds of them, at the base of the pyramid. And when we came across them, just the tops of these sculptures were peeking above the surface of the ground, but we could see, you know, jaguar heads and snakes and great jars with vultures carved on the rims and monkeys and things like that. And when it was excavated, they uncovered a lot of some really interesting, remarkable, and quite enigmatic objects. Now, most of these objects have been brought to an archaeological laboratory that the Honduran government built, and they're being curated and preserved. Some of the more spectacular ones have gone to the presidential palace. And in fact, I was just in Honduras 3 weeks ago, and they had some of the best objects they'd brought and had on display in the American embassy in Tegucigalpa, which is the capital of Honduras, for Americans to see. So the Honduran government is talking about eventually taking, you know, some of these objects and on tour and bringing them to the United States where people, Americans, can see them, because they're really interesting. They're very unusual. They're not like anything you've seen before. You know, they're great stone thrones decorated with animal heads and other things. And there's also carvings on the side that look like some kind of possibly symbolic script, but the world's greatest Maya hieroglyphic experts have looked at these things and say, well, we have no idea what they are. You know, they're not Maya.
I mean, that's fascinating.
There's something
else. I mean, they're like a complete lost culture. That's going to be wonderful to learn more about. Now, you said something in the beginning of the program that I thought was interesting, that they're limiting the excavation of the city. Why would they do that, and why wouldn't they really want to get in there and discover, you know, a possible, what we would consider a codex, a writing, or some evidence of what their culture was all about, maybe even an evolution about where they came from?
Well, I think that there are several problems. One is what I mentioned earlier, the level of disease in the valley has afflicted the archaeologists who've come in there to do the work. So, for example, the American archaeologist and his team said, we're withdrawing. We can't continue to work here. It's too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's a lot of it's very expensive, because the only way to get into the valley is with helicopters, and helicopters cost a fortune to fly. So that's another issue. And I think finally there's an issue of preservation. They want to, you know, this is some of the most pristine, unspoiled rainforest in the entire planet. The animals in this valley had never seen people before, had not seen people before. They wandered about unafraid. I've never seen anything like this when we were in there. So yeah. I think that they want to preserve that quality. That's the first thing, and probably the most important thing. Although, I will mention that there may be caves in the area, and this culture buried their dead in caves. And so if they find the caves, they will find probably the burial ground, the necropolis of the culture, and it'll be full of gorgeous artifacts, possibly even gold objects. And if they're codices or anything like that, they'll be there too.
Wow. You've mentioned a couple of times the lethal nature of that area. Let's talk about what happened with you. You contracted Leishmaniasis, which is this, they call it the white leprosy. And I guess most of the team that went in with you initially contracted this this terrible illness. Can you talk a little bit about it and what that experience was about?
Yes, it's a disease called mucocutaneous leishmaniasis, and it's one of the tropical diseases that is known to exist in Central America. I mean, there are many of them, especially in the jungle areas. But in this particular valley, it's at a level of virulence that is almost unheard of. And so the expedition, we were only in the valley for 9 days, and yet two-thirds of the expedition came down with this disease, Americans, Hondurans, and Brits alike. So it was a very, it affected a lot of people. It's transmitted by the bite of sandflies. So there's a, it's a complex disease. There's a host animal, which we don't know what that is yet. It could be a rat, could be a tapir, who knows. A host animal that carries the disease. And when a sandfly bites that host animal, it takes in the Leishmania parasites, and then when it bites you, it expels those parasites, and they get into your skin, and they start eating away your skin, creating these horrible ulcers. And eventually it moves, the ulcers move to your face, and your nose and lips fall off. They're very strongly affected by this parasite. And you're leaving your face just a weeping sore where your face used to be.
And yeah, I have to say, Doug, I actually went on to Google, and I took a look at some of the extreme cases of it. It's a horrific, incurable illness for a lot of people. I can't imagine this is terrible. It's a horrible disease.
Well, it is, and it's also a very interesting disease. I mean, you know, if you're a journalist and you're going to get a disease, you might as well get an interesting one and not a boring one.
Well, hey, tell us a little bit about what you went through in your let me just start by saying or asking, are you cured? Are you cured, officially cured?
Not really what they call a sterile cure, which means the parasite is gone from my body. But it's a cure where that beats back the disease to the point where you're fine. You feel fine, and you're going to be fine. Sometimes, not infrequently, the disease will come back and you'll have to go through another round of treatment. And then if for some reason my immune system is degraded, such as if I have chemotherapy, if I get cancer, or have to have an organ transplant, then the disease does come back for real in a very big way. So it's just, so it's with you for the rest of your life. But for me, I'm fine. I feel great. You know, I'm able to do everything I normally would able to do. And I mean, the fact is that there are people out there suffering from a lot worse than this. I mean, cancer and so forth. I mean, leishmaniasis is not as bad as many other diseases. So it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
And I got an interesting book out of it. And there's
a
medical
book.
Mystery there. Well, thank you.
But you made out fairly well, but some of the other members didn't do as well, did they?
No, and that's really very upsetting to me personally and quite tragic. And some members had to go through multiple treatments, very debilitating treatments. And there's one person who is really extremely ill and may never recover. So it's very, very upsetting and distressing to see that.
Yeah. You described the treatment as a form of chemotherapy, and you were lucky enough to work with the National Institute of Health. So are you saying that you can have high and low periods when your immune system is low or you're ill and it might come back again? So it sounds like you're saying it's in a dormant stage. Is that what I understand you're saying?
Exactly. It's a bit like, some diseases like herpes, you know, goes away most of the time, or, chicken pox, the virus can hide in your body for decades and then reemerge as shingles. It's similar to that. This is a parasite. It's a single-celled animal, and it hides inside your white blood cells. So it hides inside your immune system. It's like an invader, a spy, you know. So it's really hard to get rid of because, you know, if it's hiding in the white blood cells that are actually supposed to be killing the disease, you've got a problem. Now, unfortunately, this disease, leishmaniasis, and the HIV, if you get them in combination, it's an incredibly lethal combination because the two diseases reinforce each other, and the leishmaniasis renders the drugs that are used to combat HIV non-workable. It prevents those drugs from working, and it just absolutely wreaks havoc on your body. And the HIV leishmaniasis co-infection, they call it, is like a whole new disease, which is almost 100% fatal.
Wow. Would you have gone into this jungle had you known that the possibilities of contracting these illnesses was around?
Yes, I would. I did know going into the jungle that this was a risky business, and I was fully briefed on the dangers. It wasn't as if we were ignorant of what we were getting into, and we did take the utmost precautions against bug bites, but unfortunately you're just overwhelmed with insects. I mean, you're being bitten all over your body despite applying DEET. It's raining constantly. The second day I just gave up on using my raincoat. It was just useless. You're just soaked all day long, and there are insects all over you, chiggers and all kinds of insects, and you just, you know, you just have to live with it. And so we did know that there was this possibility, but it was worth it. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. I mean, to actually find a lost city in the 21st century somewhere on the surface of the earth is wonderful and remarkable. It's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. And to be part of that, to be in the first group in there, to walk into that city, being the first humans there in 500 years, was a very special experience.
Yes, and your book is a wonderful, detailed look at what you experienced. I have to ask you, though, Doug, your description of this deadly snake, the fer de lance, was quite chilling. And if they ever make your book into a movie, that scene alone would shake people from their seats.
Well, I think I have to say, quite honestly, I think I lost a lot of readers when that scene came along, because it's so awful. If you don't like snakes, you know, that's not a nice scene. Just to briefly summarize what happened, the first night, I personally almost stumbled over a gigantic fer de lance, coiled up, very aroused, in striking position, tracking me with his head. I'd walk by him twice. Actually, I should say her. It was a female snake, because they get bigger than the males. And this snake was gigantic. So it's tracking me, and so I backed up, and I called out, "Hey, you guys, there's a big snake over here." So the leader of the expedition and the people with him came over, and they were really astonished at the size of the snake. The fer de lance is the deadliest snake in the entire New World. A bite from that is fatal or life-changing if you survive. And so the leader of the expedition said he was going to move it, which I thought was crazy. But he cut a 7-foot-long snake stick. He pinned the snake with it, and the snake then just, like, exploded, striking in all directions. I mean, the venom was arcing through the air from these inch-long fangs as it was striking at everything. And he wrestled the snake to the ground, grabbed it behind the head, and then the snake was trying to bite him by twisting its neck around and expelled venom all over the back of his hand, and his skin was starting to bubble. So, unfortunately, instead of moving the snake, he cut off its head. And even after he cut off the head, the head continued to snap and spew venom, and the headless snake tried to crawl off. So it was like a scene out of a horror film.
Oh my God.
He got up and he then rose and calmly washed his hands, and he was British. He said, "Nothing like that to concentrate the mind, is there?"
Well, you describe, and the gentleman you're describing is Andrew Wood. He's a former British special service soldier, and he is in the book. He describes what you're about to enter and basically lays out the treacherous nature of your expedition, which is kind of a heads up. And here you are experiencing this deadly, deadly snake. And what eventually happened to everybody is the least ominous creature, a little sandfly, turned out to be the biggest problem for everybody, which I thought was quite unique.
It was. In fact, it was kind of funny in a way, because after the expedition was over and we were sitting by the pool drinking frosty beers. The leader of the expedition was mopping his brow and saying, "My God, I thank God we got out of there and nobody was killed, nobody was bitten by a snake, and nobody got sick. It's a bloody miracle." Well, his self-congratulations were a little bit premature because it took about 6 weeks. And then many of us began to notice that even though the rest of our bug bites were fading, one of them was getting worse and getting bigger and bigger and turning into a horrible, festering wound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we went into the emergency room, we consulted doctors, and they all said the same thing, "Oh, it's an infection," and gave us antibiotics. But finally, the National Geographic photographer, Dave Yoder, he just said, "Look, this does not look like an infection." So he photographed his lesion, and he sent it to two other photographers he knew at Nat Geo who had spent a lot of time in the jungle. And they both emailed him back, and they said, "Dave, we hate to tell you, but it looks like you've got leishmaniasis."
Oh,
so Dave then went to the National Institutes of Health, and they said, "Look, you have leishmaniasis, and we think everyone in your group has it. And we would like to enroll them all in a medical study because we're studying this disease, and mm-hmm. we'll give them free treatment as long as they participate in this study." So we all went to the NIH in Washington or outside of Washington, and we all got treated by the best doctors in the world, and they are now studying our disease and trying to figure out ways to combat it.
It's an amazing story. The last question I have for you is, what would you like to see this city become? Do you want it to become... And I guess a further question is, do they have a name for it? I mean, you guys have a name. You plotted it on your LIDAR scans as T1, T2, T3. Does the Honduras government plan to call it the White City, the Lost City of the Monkey God? What is the name that will be given to this new city?
Well, the president of Honduras, following a suggestion by one of the archaeologists, is calling it the City of the Jaguar. And the reason they're calling it that is, first of all, the valley is full of jaguars everywhere. And secondly, the first artifact we found, that we saw, was the head of a jaguar coming out of the ground, a beautiful, really amazing sculpture, which turned out when it was excavated to be attached to a seat, to a throne, a stone throne. Now, there's a reason why it's not going to be called the White City or the Lost City of the Monkey God. And that is because it's not really and truly the lost city as described in legend. I mean, the legends, like all legends, tended to exaggerate. Stories got told. The legends themselves are basically a metaphor for this entire civilization. And this civilization had many cities, not just one. So, in fact, the LIDAR survey revealed a second city that has not yet been visited in another valley. So that's an incredible thing. But so the legends were really a metaphor for the entire civilization and its sudden demise. So the legend, the White City, probably doesn't exist in its described form. So is the city the White City? Well, the answer is kind of yes and no. Yes, in the sense that it's one of the cities the legend is based on, but no, in the sense that, yes, there are other cities as well that were part of the building of this legend.
Okay. So maybe the Honduras government will kind of consider it, for all sake and purposes, if they ever get a traveling exhibition of the artifacts, they'd maybe call it the Lost City of Honduras Jungles or something? What would they say? Do you know? Or have an idea?
They'll just call it La Ciudad del Jaguar, which means in Spanish the City of the Jaguar. That's its now official name that the Hondurans have given it. And the valley is called the Valley of the Jaguar. Now there's also a city in T3, Target 3, which we haven't even talked about, which has not been explored. It hasn't been named. Who knows what they're going to find there? That city is a lot harder to explore because of the terrain. It's much more difficult terrain. It's really, really difficult and dangerous terrain. terrain. Mm. It's not, it's much more open. It's not this very thick jungle with these huge tall trees. Instead, it's a lot of it is this open area with grass, which is 9 to 12 feet high. It's some kind of plant which has stems that are, you know, half an inch to an inch thick. And it is absolute hell to get through it. To machete that stuff down is very difficult, and it's completely full of poisonous snakes.
Jesus. So if National Geographic said, Doug Preston, we'd like you to go in and report and create an article on this T3, what would you say?
Well, I might go in, but I think I'd always be walking behind somebody. I'm not going to be out there in front, that's for sure.
My guest has been Douglas Preston. The book, The Lost City of the Monkey God, it's been out now for, I think it came out late last year. I just heard it on my audio, Audible. It's a fantastic, true story of a lost city. Doug, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be on the show.
So that was Douglas Preston, and I have to tell you, that book is quite amazing. I have a complete gallery of images right up to the last couple of weeks of images from National Geographic. A lot of photos were taken by members of the expedition. You can see the entire gallery. It's about, I'd say, 30 photos on the Earth Ancients page, Earth Ancients. You can see it on the Facebook. Don't go to International. Go to the group page and scroll down. I've actually placed it on the top and provided a date for you to check out. I was very uncomfortable when I read about his encounter with the snake. So uncomfortable that I was looking around the ground for a good half an hour, just because it triggered a fear. You know, when you run into one of these snakes, you don't soon forget the experience. So strongly suggest that you consider getting this book and reading it. The Lost City of the Monkey God. I think we're going to hear a lot more about it. Would love to see some of the artifacts up close and personal, but we'll see what the Honduras government does. That's it for today's show. As a reminder, my guest next week is Michael Cremo, the author of Forbidden Archaeology. I consider him, and many people consider him, one of the foremost authorities on ancient civilizations and the artifacts that really reveal, according to him, that humans have been on Earth. And when I say humans, those are Homo sapiens, modern humans have been on Earth for millions of years, millions and millions of years. And he has quite the startling evidence that is proof that a lot of his theories are quite direct and show possibilities of sophisticated mankind in various epics of our Earth. So join us next week. All right, I hope you have a great day. Thanks. Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia, and you can get over 7,000 titles on the Gaia website. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. And for just 99 cents for the first month, you can see some amazing titles. So check it out. www.gaia.com/Earth Ancients.